Are you a tenant in Montreal? Do you have questions about your rights? Your local housing committee can help. To find the housing committee for your neighborhood or for more resources, go to www.rclalq.qc.ca.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
Hello, and welcome to the CJPNE Debrief Podcast, a project of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East and a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. Together, we discuss developments and issues in Canada's relationship with Palestine and the broader Middle East. Through our conversations, we make sense of events in the region and how people in Canada can respond. Earlier this year, McGill students won a major victory when a campus referendum passed by 71% to adopt a Palestine solidarity policy. Almost immediately, however, this decision was suppressed and revoked by university administrators and the student association. Today, I'm joined by members of Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights, SPHR McGill, to discuss their recent victory and how they are dealing with McGill's attempts to crush student activism. My name is Michael Beaker, Vice President of CJPME and the podcast host for today. And I'm very excited to be joined today by Sarah and Rafi, who are members of SPHR McGill. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah.
Really excited to get a chance to talk to you as we've been following the situation at McGill very closely. There have been some big victories as well as some pretty big disappointments. So I think we're happy to have a chance to dig into that a little bit. You know, many of our listeners may know that on March 21st, undergraduate students at McGill overwhelmingly voted to pass a Palestine solidarity policy. The referendum passed with 71% of the vote. And in a statement, your group called this a historic victory. Why is this vote so important, do you think?
Well, SPHR and McGill has been trying to educate students on what's happening in Palestine and what Palestinian students at McGill face for a pretty long time now. And the fact that we got a 71.1% referendum like vote is it's pretty big, because it means that our efforts, they, you know, it's working, where people are learning, people are starting to listen, they're starting to understand and to, you know, act on it. So yeah, it's pretty huge.
I would say to take it even a little bit further, mm-hmm. statistically, just 71% is pretty dominant as far as you can go for addressing something in a court of public opinion. But in addition to that, I mean, we obviously were, we were under like a lot of scrutiny with this, especially because, you know, this was controversial to begin with. Like even getting the Palestine Solidarity Policy on the board was a task in and of itself. I mean, I'm not sure if how much detailed listeners know, but there were issues even getting it on the referendum ballot to begin with. People had been contesting its status through the use of the student union's judicial board, and somebody contested even being there, and we didn't even get a chance to get it on the ballot until a couple of days after the ballot had been issued initially. So, I mean, that's just one part of it. But historically, I'd say there's even the fact that other campuses haven't had nearly as much discussion regarding Palestine and solidarity. Having come from another campus myself, but McGill has always seemed to be at the forefront of these discussions. And for this to take such a big, prevalent public spot at McGill made it even bigger. So as far as other students and other student unions were concerned, this is probably one of the most visible sort of public demonstrations of support for Palestine by a student body. You know, UBC and U of T's recent victories notwithstanding, of course.
Yeah, certainly 70%. I mean, it's a landslide victory. And as you say, following a lot of, attacks from your opponents, misinterpreting what this is. And it seems to me, too, that McGill, you know, a lot of universities have in the past, over the past 15 years, passed various policies in support of BDS or in solidarity with Palestine. And I think this is certainly the biggest such initiative that has passed at McGill. But in the past, I think it's been difficult for McGill students to pass things like that. Isn't that the case?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And previous divestment votes have not been ratified and that kind of thing. It seems like there's a lot more bureaucratic hurdles at McGill than there are maybe at other student unions. But so why then in this case do you think that this vote was so successful?
Well, I think part of it definitely goes to, so just touching on the earlier question of how troublesome this issue has been in terms of bringing it to the forefront, and especially like, you know, a little bit of comparisons to why this was a little bit more successful in the past. Like you can go back to 2016 and questions of BDS were being discussed then as to whether or not, you know, student government generally could even endorse or even like approve of a club or any organizations at the university who could talk about those. And, you know, I think there's an element of people are looking at this more critically. There's a lot more scrutiny. Recent events, for example, stretching all the way back to May 2021, such as, you know, the bombings in Gaza that happened around the end of May, have really brought forth, I think, a lot more public scrutiny on things. I think is one of a few different catalysts. Of course, we have a very active number of groups who've been working together, not just at McGill, but you know, quick shout out to Concordia. Concordia's Solidarity with Palestine group has been absolutely phenomenal in terms of both working with us and working within the Montreal community and the university network, generally speaking.
Yeah, I think certainly the events of last year seem to have had these follow-on effects. And sort of historically, I think we often see waves of successful BDS votes following various military offensives in Gaza, as people are, you know, their awareness is sort of renewed about the issues. Did you expect this vote to win?
I think we did. We were pretty confident about it passing. But we also knew that we were going to receive a lot of backlash when it did. So we were more so preparing for what was to come after the referendum passed and not during, even though like there was a lot of opposition during, but it was more what's to come, less what is happening in the moment, if that makes sense.
It's funny because I feel like a lot of the work that we've been doing this year has very much been, as Sarah has just mentioned, like once you get something done, being immediately ready for the next thing to kind of come back at us.
Yeah,
there's definitely been a lot of, I guess, a backlash to this, to say the least. But before we get into that, could you maybe tell us a little bit about what the Palestine Solidarity Policy is and maybe some of the key measures within it?
Absolutely. So the Palestine Solidarity Policy, pretty much what it has, we can say about 4 points. That's probably the easiest way to summarize it. And what it does is it commits the SMU, which is the student union at McGill, to boycott corporations and institutions that are complicit in settler colonial apartheid, and to campaign for the University of McGill to also do the same, for them to divest from corporations and to like push McGill to publicly condemn surveillance or smear campaigns against Palestinians and pro-Palestinian students, such as Canary Mission. And it forms a Palestine Solidarity Committee within the SMU to help Palestinian students in McGill and move towards like Palestinian liberation. And that's pretty much like a summary of what the policy is. Rafi, do you have anything you want to add?
Yeah, I mean, I think you covered it pretty well. A lot of what we, like the question itself kind of establishes the framework within which we could actually achieve all this. And as Sarah just mentioned, the formation committees, but we made sure to provide as much detail and as much historical precedent for such mechanisms. So I think that, yeah, a lot of listeners are probably familiar with in the late 1970s to 1980s, a lot of different Canadian universities made sure to cut ties with institutions and corporations complicit in South African apartheid, for instance. You know, obviously, Israel being recognized as an apartheid state allows us to draw from this precedent, draw from the South African precedent and models of divestment pretty solidly. So yeah, we've done our best to, you know, follow precedent while also expanding where needed to, you know, adapt to the situation, especially the, as Asada mentioned, the different spear campaigns, different blacklists that have been used to, you know, combat a, you know, pro-Palestinian liberation narrative.
Yeah, it definitely seems like it's pretty expansive in the sense that, as you say, it doesn't just talk about policies, but about structures that can maybe advocate for those policies or implement them, such as a committee. Yeah, it's interesting that it's, I guess, taken from the president of the McGill efforts to combat apartheid South Africa, which itself was also very contested. I think a lot of people look back and think that everyone was on the same side against apartheid, but it's just not the case. The board of governors at McGill was actually very strongly opposed to any efforts to divest. And there were professors on campus that were part of these South Africa groups. So definitely there's a lot of precedent here to learn from. And I guess, unfortunately, unlike the case with the divestment from South Africa, this vote, once it was passed by students, it was immediately overturned, essentially. Maybe I'll just run through a couple of the things that happened and then we can talk about them more. But I mean, as soon as this resolution was passed, you know, in this landslide vote, the university stepped in to say that the policy would create excessive polarization. They claimed that it violated the university's values and the student union's constitution. I saw this email from McGill University's deputy provost, basically threatening to terminate the memorandum of agreement with the student union if they did not take action to stop the policy, effectively threatening the fees of students. And I've actually been in a role in the student union that was in a similar situation, not over this issue, but also had threats to their student fees. And it puts you in a position of, I mean, putting essentially your student services essentially at risk if you don't know if they're going to be able to maintain their operations over the next year. So it's a really serious situation. And then unfortunately, it seems like this threat worked. And then a month later, the Student Union's Board of Directors decides that they won't ratify the referendum, which means that the policy won't be adopted by SMU. And then even more recently, my understanding is that after you criticize these decisions not to respect student democracy, the student union actually suspended your group from accessing union resources, which I guess means you won't be able to be reimbursed for your expenses. So this is pretty intense. What do you make of this response?
Well, right away, I think it's pretty clear there's a bunch of different things at work here in terms of, you know, one, clearly any sort of criticism levied against the SMU's board of directors, which, to be completely honest, we've taken to calling the board dictators, because at this point, that's kind of how they're behaving. Any sort of criticism being met with sanctions, the fact that we've had constitutionally approved fees and expenses that we've paid for that were meant to be reimbursed that they've chosen to withhold thus far, whether that's due to incompetence on their end or an actual active attempt to suppress our financial freedom to actually do anything, that's another question altogether. But yeah, the another thing about, sorry, as you mentioned, the deputy provost Fabrice Labou did not only just you said basically threatened, actively actually threatened, right, the student union, but also went so far as to sort of try to put together a new spin on a narrative to in the public eye. I'm sure listeners who've been paying attention to this, especially those at McGill, are aware that Nabu actually tried to frame this as an issue of Islamophobia and anti-Semitism on campus, really sort of generalizing, diluting the actual issue here and reframing it as something else altogether. Not something that we didn't expect to see, although the manner in which it was done really was pretty insulting to sort of try to describe what seems to be a visible push to, you know, address investor interests as one of human rights protections. Yeah, there's a bunch of different elements here that really not only, I guess, look to devalidate or sort of delegitimize our push for reform, but really seem to try to prevent a narrative to actually address this through whatever they want to do constitutionally, or sorry, student government constitution approved remedies, by putting together ad hoc committees, by criticizing this as, like I said, what an issue of human rights rather than an issue of what is pretty clearly financial protection. Sada, am I missing anything here?
Covering it all, yeah. No, I agree with everything that's been said. So far, it's just all a bunch of, like we said, the actions that are being carried out by the SMU Board of Dictators are the reason that we have decided to call them the Board of Dictators. You know, it's just another form of trying to silence Palestinian students on campus, really. Disappointed, but not surprised.
And for those who are wondering, we have chosen to appeal this decision, if only to see if there's any sort of actual objective aspect to all of this, but mm-hmm. We have yet to hear anything back from them.
So the decision by the board of directors to not ratify the referendum result, that's what you're appealing?
Rather the sanction. The decision to ratify the result has been expressed to us as final and absolute in almost every sense. So we can, I think at this point, it's really trying to, a lot of what we're going to be doing this summer and this upcoming little while is seeing how to best address this. Obviously, we have a bit of a turnover in our group, but it's a main focus for sure to do that. The sanction itself is really what we've chosen to address to see if there's actually any sort of independent aspect to criticisms that they can raise against us.
Right, because this was in response, the sanction you're talking about is in response to a parody letter that you posted that's sort of taking aim at the decision of the board of directors not to ratify the decision. And they actually said that this was that you were harassing board members and that this was basically a violation of policies, and that so coming to this decision of suspending your organization from resources, is what are the fees like for a referendum that you're not being reimbursed for?
Honestly, so SBHR McGill has, we really try to be independent from SMU a lot of the times. So this is more of a publicity stunt to us than anything else.
Because it's more of a statement than an act, something exactly, with actual concrete consequences.
Exactly. Because we depend more on Cooper and them rather than depending on SMU because of how SMU has reacted to us historically. There's just not a very good basis of trust with them. But yeah.
So what has been the mood on campus then? It seems to me that if most students vote for a policy and then it gets essentially shut down at these various levels, that would be pretty frustrating. Are people angry?
Oh yeah. When your student union, when you vote for a certain thing in your student union and then that's your, that student union takes it down, I mean, you're going to be angry. It sort of takes away any confidence you have in them. Not sort of, it literally does.
Yeah. There's also the issue that, you know, when you have a democratically approved motion, you know, a whole, you know, an issue that's been made available to be voted on by the student body, and then the student body does vote on it and overwhelmingly shows what their take on it is or what their stance is by supporting the Palestine Solidarity Policy, to have an administration that says, okay, I see that, but also we're going to choose to completely ignore this and ignore the little bit of autonomy that we pretended that you would have. It goes beyond simply at this point. Like, obviously, our focus is always going to be on Palestine and Palestinian liberation and a free and safe space to, you know, to be activists in that sense. But when that sort of democratic aspect of governance is absolutely removed or overruled, yeah, we've been having a lot of conversations with different groups on campus who've expressed not just frustration, but straight up anger at the fact that clearly voting doesn't mean anything, because at the end of the day, it's voting as long as it fits a certain, tolerable standard.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, I mean, theoretically, this is a threat to all sorts of different kinds of organizing on campus, because if they Absolutely. Can simply shut down the decision of students on Palestine, well, what prevents them from doing this to any other issue, whether, you know, migrant rights, climate justice, all sorts of things?
Yeah, it's absolutely.
And then I know that there were emergency rallies by students against this attack on democracy. There were other expressions of, I guess, opposition that we saw from students, but also from faculty. On April 5th, there was this open letter from more than 100 McGill faculty and staff in support of the Palestine Solidarity Policy, endorsing that policy. And I'll just read a little bit from this. We, faculty and staff at McGill, endorse the adoption of the Palestine Solidarity Policy, which campaigns for a demonstration of leadership in matters of human rights and social justice. Generations of students have played a central role in advocating for justice, sustainability, and anti-apartheid measures. We support the students' right to utilize democratic channels in order to campaign for these matters that impact the entire academic community. That's pretty great. Has that been a help to you to have faculty come out in support of you?
Absolutely. Just seeing that the fact that there are faculty that support us, it's great. Not to mention, it shows others that this is, you know, it's a real thing that's going on right now in McGill. It's one thing when students say it, but when faculty members choose to stand up and speak up, it really shows the importance of speaking up when something like this happens.
And personally speaking, you know, I was very proud to see, I'm part of a faculty that tends to be very, how do you say, either tight-lipped on issues or very vocal on issues. Unfortunately, this has not been one of them, historically speaking. But to see, I counted four professors from my faculty specifically. I can say I'm really proud to see them. I'm really proud to see, you know, leaders in the academic world choose to go out and support us in everything that we've been doing. As I'm sure a lot of listeners know, there's a big academic hotbed for pro-Palestinian liberation that exists in North America, as well as Ireland specifically. Academics for Palestine and Academia Against Apartheid are all very big or are all very important organizations, both in terms of organization itself and in terms of, you know, motivation and spirit for the issue, that talk about the push against Zionism, at least as it shows itself on campus.
Yeah, and for this to happen at McGill too, like these are faculty members of McGill specifically, which is not something we've seen so much in the past. We got over 80 signatures from McGill faculty.
Well, I wanted to maybe look back a little bit at the overall context of this vote, because as was mentioned earlier, the McGill vote happened at a time when there were a lot of similar votes being passed by student unions across the country. So just in this one semester between January and April, the University of Toronto passed a motion to divest funds and forbid investment in firms that are complicit in the occupation of Palestinian territory. You have Concordia Student Union pass an anti-apartheid policy that includes measures to divest from any investments and withdraw support from states or businesses that are involved in apartheid. At the University of British Columbia, the student union passed a motion pushing on the university to divest from businesses in the settlements and other violations of Palestinian human rights. And at Simon Fraser, their student society unanimously, their council adopts a Palestinian liberation policy, committing to a whole bunch of things, including support for BDS. I note that some of these student unions, UBC, McGill, UFT undergrads, are places where actually they're quite slow. There are other campuses that have been more active on this, and these are student unions that have been, to a large extent, holdouts until now. And yet they're all coming to these pretty amazing victories all at the same time. Why do you think there's such a renewed momentum around this?
I guess it's sort of like a domino effect, I would say. When you see others coming to these like resolutions and having these victories, you feel like, you know, we can do this too. Let's go forward and put our own like referendum up and try to have our own victories at our own campuses. And then when you do have those victories, other campuses see the same, and then they get that confidence to put it forth as well?
We've been, a lot of different universities and different solidarity groups across Canada, not to mention a little bit in the States as well. We've been very much going out of our way to support each other. If anybody needs any resources, any help putting together campaigns, any sort of information, we actively try to make sure that everybody has everything they need. And obviously, as Sada just mentioned, just having support for one, or just the domino effect and seeing that somebody can succeed is huge. To know that, obviously a lot of universities have been met with challenges throughout a little while. Seeing somebody like U of T be able to pass something despite the backlash that they received is huge. UBC as well. These are big academic institutions that have been met with a lot of backlash. So when one gets going, it shows that through staunch support and determination, really we can get a lot of stuff done.
There's one other part of this whole situation that I did want to briefly touch on, which is that in the Palestine Solidarity, one of the pillars of that was to get the university to condemn this blacklist, which has been terrorizing pro-Palestine students at McGill, which your group discovered last year, that this blacklist exists, has apparently been circulating on campus for some time. Can you just say a little bit about this blacklist and what this means for pro-Palestine students on campus?
Yeah, for sure. So this blacklist, we published an article on it, on the existence of it, and it pretty much it documents certain students that are suspected of holding any like pro-Palestinian sympathies, and the main thing is that it's a really big part of the intimidation tactics that are used against these students to dissuade or threaten or discourage students, Palestinian or not, on campus and outside campus too, and to, push them away from the cause. But it doesn't work, to, say the least.
It hasn't stopped you from organizing?
No, absolutely not. Nothing like that would ever have that effect. And there were a couple testimonies from several sources, and there was a student, an anonymous student, who spoke up as being viciously like doxxed and sexually harassed online. But McGill administration and SMU didn't really listen when anyone tried to talk to them. This was around May of last year, I believe. So the student appealed to SBHR, and that's, one of the biggest reasons that we've put it in the Palestine Solidarity Policy, because doxing and surveillance and all that stuff of Palestinian students or pro-Palestinian students or just people in general that are pro-Palestine is something that we've seen a lot. One of the biggest examples of this is Canary Mission. We have, from McGill alone, we have about 6 faculty members on Canary Mission and over 20 students, which is huge, and it's constantly being updated.
And Canary Mission, just to jump in, is this international anonymous blacklist website that lists students, faculty, anyone basically who's involved in Palestine could end up on this web page and have the details of all of their statements, all of their actions meticulously documented and framed in a way to try to present them as anti-Semitic or supporters of terrorism, and then use that to get them basically fired from their jobs or to lose out on other opportunities. And the Israeli government even uses that as a database for determining whether to bar people from entering the country. So it's an awful, awful situation.
Horrible. Yeah. And even it's not just, it's publicly available. So it's not only the Israeli government that has access to this, it's also future job opportunities, future educational opportunities. It's a really big problem for something like that to exist.
Mm-hmm. But the blacklist at McGill wasn't public. It was a private thing that was being circulated among, I guess, a group of students.
Exactly. Yeah, it wasn't made public, but we called for an investigation into this. And until today, we haven't really got anything concrete out of SMU or McGill in response to this, to the existence of this blacklist.
And I guess one of the, in your letter that you published, I guess one of the supposed outcomes of this blacklist was to get, was to basically target maybe student candidates for different elections who are supportive of Palestine to help people organize against them. Is that right?
Yeah. It was to intimidate, but also to influence others as to the reputation of these students. Although it was held in a tight circle, but a lot of the people that we believe it circulated with are ones who hold pretty high positions within SMU and the such. So it did have like an effect on students.
That's terrible. That's really disgusting.
Horrible.
Well, unfortunately, it's not surprising anymore at this point, the way that rhetoric has been restructured to, you know, the same way that we can very validly criticize the government of Canada for actions for anything, you know, it's our democratic right. It's something that we are entitled to as citizens, as people with, just human rights. The fact that now our ability to criticize a government in its actions, the fact that's being reframed as bigotry, and the fact that people can now, without much more context and with a very harsh reframing of the matter, publish such statements online, painting people as people who ultimately look to violate human rights. It's a big attempt to really just, it's kind of like just like a universal character like smearing campaign.
It's so heavy-handed, all of this, from the blacklist to the university's threats against the student union, the student union's abandonment of the will of their members. Has this experience changed your approach to campus activism going forward? Are you discouraged? Are you mobilized even further?
I don't think discouragement is really in our vocabulary as an organization. As we've spoken, if anything, we've been, if not just as active, maybe a little bit more. Obviously, this has been a big focus for us this year, was the policy. So, you know, despite the fact that, you know, it's been met with challenges, if anything, this goes to show the institutional issues that activists will be met with. And at the very least, now that we've been able to see this and bring it to the forefront, like even having the chance to discuss this with you today, Michael, has been very helpful. Just to let people know, this is something that we face when we, you know, look to advocate for not just pro-Palestinian liberation, but a safe space to advocate for Palestinian liberation. You know, the fact that they're willing to show their true colors like this so visibly, if anything, is a bonus for us.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, it really sends a message, doesn't it, to students? One hand, this is the victory, even though it's been overturned, the victory remains of the vote itself and the expression of popular support for Palestine on campus. And it was taken away through anti-democratic means, not through any fault of its own. So it seems to me that it puts you in a good position going forward for next steps, whatever those might be.
Absolutely. Yeah. I feel like most students, when they see the threat as it is, it doesn't dissuade the student from approaching it. When it's hidden, it's more, you know, like, oh, should I not? But now that it's out in the open, it's, you know exactly, you can go forward knowing what to do, you can plan.
The fact that everybody knows that it's a 71% like agreement on supporting Palestine, it lets people know they shouldn't be scared to speak up anymore.
Yeah,
right. Exactly. That support is there.
Exactly.
Well, Rafi and Sarah, it's been a pleasure to talk to you today. Before we go, is there any final points you'd like to add that you'd like people to know?
One thing I'd say is, if you're out there and you're a McGill student, or if you're somebody anywhere on any campus or off campus who has the chance to keep fighting for things, despite whatever barriers might be getting thrown at you, like, we have our own administrative barriers, we're still going to be here for the length of our time at McGill, and we're going to be trying to fight this as hard as we can, in whatever capacity. Yeah,
and we're always available for any help that or advice or anything.
And yeah. I'll make sure to put your the SBHR contact information in the notes for this episode, so that anyone listening can easily find you.
Yeah, that'd be great.
It's lovely.
Absolutely. So, thanks so much, Rafi and Sarah.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks for having us.
Anytime.
Pleasure's all ours, Michael.
If you're a listener and you've enjoyed our podcast today, please subscribe to our channel. We're on all the major audio podcast platforms. If you can, please leave a positive review wherever you get your podcast. It helps other people find our program and learn about these issues. This podcast is a project of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, CJPME, and seeks to advance its mission to empower Canadians of all backgrounds to promote justice, development, and peace in the Middle East. If you've enjoyed this podcast, you may enjoy CJPME's other podcast, All Things Palestinian Canadian, with host Noor Wattad. You can check that out also wherever you get your podcasts. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions about our podcasts or our topics, please feel free to email us at info@cjpme.org. Thanks to all our supporters who make everything we do possible, and to Madeline Moffitt, our podcast engineer and consultant. That's it for now. See you on the next episode.
My name is Mona Shaheen. I'm an environmental and climate activist. I'm a Palestinian who lives in Haifa. Right now, we're in this area where there used to be different villages on the coast. And these villages were ruined, right? Tantura, Ain al-Ghazali, Ajzam. And the people had to flee, had to run away. Some of the villages are just completely ruined. Some of the trees are covering part of them. Other parts, just Israeli settlements built inside even some of the houses. There are almost no Palestinian villages on the sea right now. The coast is completely out of our reach. So this is classical, painful, ruined villages and damaged villages that people have been forced to leave.
What's the story?
For me, the story is distance that has been created between the Palestinian and this land. We feel that we don't really belong to this place anymore. That there has been an Israeli policy of distancing Palestinians from the land and from nature. We feel kind of alienated from our land. There has been various policies taken to create the situation. One of them is it's planting trees that are not local. These pine trees that have been planted here, they grow fast. They look good. They're not local again. They've been changing the face of the land and then planting all these pine trees and, you know, like changing the face of the land in a way that doesn't have the deep understanding that my people do have in their memory. So we speak about olive tree, we speak about fig tree, we speak about, you know, like different carob tree. These are the trees that are native to this land. Pine tree is not. And so you come and there's no traditional link happening there because there's no connection. A lot of the Palestinian connection to the land happens through connection to the land that you work in, because a lot of the Palestinians used to be farmers. And so the connection to the land is really the connection to your land. Many of these properties were confiscated. Again, another place where the connection is lost, right? So we lose the connection because we lose our lands. And then whatever nature is left, when you go to nature, you feel this is Israeli nature. It's not mine. All nature is turned now into Israeli, right? The animals have Israeli names, everything. Like, this is the Israeli snake, the Israeli bird, the Israeli tree, the Israeli plant. The plants themselves, they've been given names in Hebrew. And all that creates like a really big feeling of belonging to the Jewish people, to the land. One goal is really to strengthen the Israeli identity here. And the other one is to weaken the Palestinian identity. I grew up with my grandmother. She lived with us. And she used to live in this village where where she told us amazing stories of the way that they used to live, and really simple, beautiful life. And when she got like sick and she couldn't really move, she would ask us to go and pick things for her. And as a kid, we always went once a year. Like, there was a month or two in a year we would go picking olives, all the families together. And like, really, that's, I think, the deepest experience of nature. It's a deep experience of everything. People singing and eating together and really being immersed in this family connection to earth, which was really amazing. Like, there's a really, really deep connection to the trees, you know? You treat the tree as your friend. You appreciate the tree. You, like, the olives themselves, there's something about olives, you know? It's almost sacred. They're amazing. It's really, like, such an important tradition. And it's so funny that Israel now made the olive tree their national tree, you know? Like, for God's sakes. This is like the Palestinian icon, you know? With the whole stories of ruining the olive trees for the people in the West Bank, with such lack of sensitivity. And it's like stepping on your identity, like crushing it, you know? It's, looking at the environmental issues and the climate change that's happening, I often find myself puzzled why there's no real activity inside the Palestinian community around this issue. Once we start connecting to the beauty of our heritage and our lineage and start finding the connection to the land, to the plants, to the trees, to also to people, obviously. But once we find that connection again, then I think that you can stand up straight again, because you know that you're supported by the whole universe, right? What we need to do is to start changing our attitude in our lives, remembering the way our grandparents used to live, drop the shame of it. I choose to start a movement in which we raise awareness to what's happening, to the connection between the politics and the climate crisis, to how the occupation is creating even more damage to the climate. I choose to bring my voice up. I choose to go and speak. For other people, it might be to go and do something else. They might want to do direct action. They might want to do demonstration. I don't know. I think activism has many ways and many faces to it. The main thing is that we make a different choice of the way that we're living. Climate crisis is a survival issue. I worry for my kids. That's the main thing. I really worry for my kids. I wonder whether they're going to have the same possibilities that I had. I try to take them as much as possible to nature because I want them to get acquainted with nature, because I don't know how long it's going to last. You know, when they talk about being parents, I don't know.
Ah! My name is Basil Adra from Misafir Yatta in the southern West Bank. I am a local journalist and activist. Almost every day I take my camera and I follow what's going on in the field in the area of Misafir Yatta.
What's the story?
The story of Misafir Yatta, it's a forceful transfer and land theft. At the 4th of May of this year, the Israeli occupation court and what they call it the Israeli High Court of Justice gave the army, the Israeli army, the green light to forcibly evacuate residents of 8 Palestinian villages of Misafir Yatta. This is a brutal tool and it's a lie that they declare our land where we've been living for centuries here in the area as a firing zone. There are communities which is not in the firing zone or not in the active firing zone as they call it. In these villages, for example, they are continuing by demolition also homes and preventing people to get build permissions or a water supply or electricity or to build a paved road. And as well, they're the people most get like harassed by the Israeli settlers on the daily basis, harassed in the fields, harassed and going, moving between the Palestinian communities. Army come and raid our villages, like my village, my home, got raids since February until today, at least 7 times at night. The army raids during the nights into our homes has clearly created a fear situation. My two young sisters, who's 7 and 8, Tasneem and Asinat, are really facing hard time and afraid going to bed at night. The soldiers, when they raid our home, they throw stun grenades in front of our door. Violently detain my father and my sisters have watched and witnessed that. My first memory from witnessing an soldier's attack or settler's violence, it's I remember when I was 7 years old, and in that age the Israeli soldiers raiding our homes during the night and violently taking us and force us to move out from the home. Me, my mother, my siblings, my father as well, our neighbors in the village, just the soldiers go home by home, taking everyone outside, making us gather in a circle in the center of the village, and the soldiers will start threatening the adults, like our parents. At that time, for example, I was really afraid of sleeping at night, and mostly I would sleep with my shoes, because when the soldiers come at night, they grab us without giving us a time even to wear, even to give me a time like to wear my shoes. So I would, I remember very well me walking on a dirt road, not paved, inside the village and very cold, because they come, the soldiers come after midnight. When I was 9 years old, I watched and seen 6 Israeli soldiers brutally beating my father because he was in the field with our flocks grazing it around my village. But one settler claimed that the land belonged to him, so he ordered the soldiers to chase my father away. And when my father refused to go away, the soldiers start beating him brutally, violently, taking him inside the military jeep and arrest him. It create a big fear inside me and make me understand that I am living in a situation, it's unnormal, and we're facing this monster of the occupation from the settlers and the soldiers. It continued until today, until exactly March 2020, I was attacked and beaten by also 4 soldiers in the same field where my father was, because I was documenting these soldiers chasing another shepherd from that field.
Oh,
The occupation army roles in this area is very clear. It's to protect settlers and to allow them to do what they want. It's not that a group of extremist settlers want to do attacks, but they are invested and they are supported by the Israeli army and the Israeli authority to commit this against us. When a group of settlers come to attack our village, backed with the soldiers who come with them from the outpost, until our village and allow them to attack us. These are the same soldiers who come with a bulldozer when the bulldozer come to bulldozer our homes. Since I grew up, I witnessed and document hundreds of these demolitions going on in this area, and it's the most heartbreaking for myself. I can feel that everyone living in fear at that moment and worried about his home. It's my home, it's my bathroom, it's the school of my village, it's the water pipe that's coming to supply water to my home. It's my solar panel. There I stand, I document, I see the tears of the children, the mothers, the people around them also cry because they know that they have the same thing gonna happen to them.
So that's it for us for today. You're listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
There's a lot going on in the world today. See how it affects Montreal's Black and Caribbean community. Read the Community Contact. News, features, opinions, music reviews, cultural events, and so much more. Our voices, our perspectives, our community. Published every 2 weeks, pick it up at your favorite community spot or visit us online at our new and dynamic website, mtlcommunitycontact.com. Easy to navigate and lots to enjoy. Archived issues also on the
following is a previously broadcast program.